Donaldson the specifics of the president's request because he was consciously trying not to involve her in the investigation. But Donaldson inferred that the president's directive was related to the Russia investigation. Footnote 592. Donaldson prepared to resign along with McGahn. Footnote 593. That evening, McGahn called both Priebus and Bannon and told them that he intended to resign. Footnote 594. McGahn recalled that, after speaking with his attorney and given the nature of the president's request, he decided not to share details of the president's request with other White House staff. Footnote 595. Priebus recalled that McGahn said that the president had asked him to do crazy shit, but he thought McGahn did not tell him the specifics of the president's request because McGahn was trying to protect Priebus from what he did not need to know. Footnote 596. Priebus and Bannon both urged McGahn not to quit, and McGahn ultimately returned to work that Monday and remained in his position. Footnote 597. He had not told the president directly that he planned to resign. And when they next saw each other, the president did not ask McGahn whether he had followed through with calling Rosenstein. Footnote 598. Around the same time, Chris Christie recalled a telephone call with the president, in which the president asked what Christie thought about the president firing the special counsel. Footnote 599. Christie advised against doing so because there was no substantive basis for the president to fire the special counsel, and because the president would lose support from Republicans in Congress if he did so. Footnote 600. Analysis. In analyzing the president's direction to McGahn to have the special counsel removed, the following evidence is relevant to the elements of obstruction of justice. A. Obstructive act. As with the president's firing of Comey, the attempt to remove the special counsel would qualify as an obstructive act if it would naturally obstruct the investigation and any grand jury proceedings that might flow from the inquiry. Even if the removal of the lead prosecutor would not prevent the investigation from continuing under a new appointee, a fact finder would need to consider whether the act had the potential to delay further action in the investigation, chill the actions of any replacement special counsel, or otherwise impede the investigation. A threshold question is whether the president in fact directed McGahn to have the special counsel removed. After news organizations reported that in June 2017, the president had ordered McGahn to have the special counsel removed, the president publicly disputed these accounts and privately told McGahn that he had simply wanted McGahn to bring conflicts of interest to the Department of Justice's attention. See Volume 2, Section 2.1, Infra. Some of the president's specific language that McGahn recalled from the calls is consistent with that explanation. Substantial evidence, however, supports the conclusion that the president went further and in fact directed McGahn to call Rosenstein to have the special counsel removed. First, McGahn's clear recollection was that the president directed him to tell Rosenstein not only that conflicts existed, but also that Mueller has to go. McGahn is a credible witness with no motive to lie or exaggerate, given the position he held in the White House. Footnote 601. McGahn spoke with the president twice and understood the directive the same way both times, making it unlikely that he misheard or misinterpreted the president's request. In response to that request, McGahn decided to quit because he did not want to participate in events that he described as akin to the Saturday night massacre. He called his lawyer, drove to the White House, packed up his office, prepared to submit a resignation letter with his chief of staff, told Priebus that the president had asked him to do crazy shit, and informed Priebus and Bannon that he was leaving. Those acts would be a highly unusual reaction to a request to convey information to the Department of Justice. Second, in the days before the calls to McGahn, the president, through his counsel, had already brought the asserted conflicts to the attention of the Department of Justice. Accordingly, the president had no reason to have McGahn call Rosenstein that weekend to raise conflicts issues that already had been raised. Third, the president's sense of urgency and repeated requests to McGahn to take immediate action on a weekend, you gotta do this, you gotta call Rod, support McGahn's recollection that the president wanted the Department of Justice to take action to remove the special counsel. Had the president instead sought only to have the Department of Justice re-examine asserted conflicts to evaluate whether they posed an ethical bar, it would have been unnecessary to set the process in motion on a Saturday and to make repeated calls to McGahn. Finally, the president had discussed knocking out Mueller and raised conflicts of interest in a May 23, 2017 call with McGahn, reflecting that the president connected the conflicts to a plan to remove the special counsel. And in the days leading up to June 17, 2017, the president made clear to Priebus and Bannon, who then told Ruddy, that the president was considering terminating the special counsel. Also during this time period, the president reached out to Christie to get his thoughts on firing the special counsel. This evidence shows that the president was not just seeking an examination of whether conflicts existed, but instead was looking to use asserted conflicts as a way to terminate the special counsel. B. Nexus to an official proceeding. To satisfy the proceeding requirement, it would be necessary to establish a nexus between the president's act of seeking to terminate the special counsel and a pending or foreseeable grand jury proceeding. Substantial evidence indicates that by June 17, 2017, the president knew his conduct was under investigation by a federal prosecutor who could present any evidence of federal crimes to a grand jury. On May 23, 2017, McGahn explicitly warned the president that his biggest exposure was not his act of firing Comey, but his other contacts and calls, and his ask re Flynn. By early June, it was widely reported in the media that federal prosecutors had issued grand jury subpoenas in the Flynn inquiry, and that the special counsel had taken over the Flynn investigation. Footnote 602. On June 9, 2017, the special counsel's office informed the White House that investigators would be interviewing intelligence agency officials who allegedly had been asked by the president to push back against the Russia investigation. On June 14, 2017, news outlets began reporting that the president was himself being investigated for obstruction of justice. Based on widespread reporting, the president knew that such an investigation could include his request for Comey's loyalty, his request that Comey let Flynn go, his outreach to Coates and Rogers, and his termination of Comey and statement to the Russian foreign minister that the termination had relieved great pressure related to Russia. And on June 16, 2017, the day before he directed McGahn to have the special counsel removed, the president publicly acknowledged that his conduct was under investigation by a federal prosecutor, tweeting, "I am being investigated for firing the FBI director by the man who told me to fire the FBI director." C. Intent. Substantial evidence indicates that the president's attempts to remove the special counsel were linked to the special counsel's oversight of investigations that involved the president's conduct, and, most immediately, to reports that the president was being investigated for potential obstruction of justice. Before the president terminated Comey, the president considered it critically important that he was not under investigation and that the public not erroneously think he was being investigated. As described in Volume 2, Section 2D, Supra, advisors perceived the president, while he was drafting the Comey termination letter, to be concerned more than anything else about getting out that he was not personally under investigation. When the president learned of the appointment of the special counsel on May 17, 2017, he expressed further concern about the investigation, saying, "This is the end of my presidency." The president also faulted Sessions for recusing, saying, "You were supposed to protect me." On June 14, 2017, when the Washington Post reported that the special counsel was investigating the president for obstruction of justice, the president was facing what he had wanted to avoid: a criminal investigation into his own conduct that was the subject of widespread media attention. The evidence indicates that news of the obstruction investigation prompted the president to call McGahn and seek to have the special counsel removed. By mid-June, the Department of Justice had already cleared the special counsel's service, and the president's advisors had told him that the claimed conflicts of interest were silly and did not provide a basis to remove the special counsel. On June 13th, 2017, the acting attorney general testified before Congress that no good cause for removing the special counsel existed, and the president dictated a press statement to Sanders saying he had no intention of firing the special counsel. But the next day, the media reported that the president was under investigation for obstruction of justice, and the special counsel was interviewing witnesses about events related to possible obstruction, spurring the president to write critical tweets about the special counsel's investigation. The president called McGahn at home that night and then called him on Saturday from Camp David. The evidence accordingly indicates that news that an obstruction investigation had been opened is what led the president to call McGahn to have the special counsel terminated. There is also evidence that the president knew that he should not have made those calls to McGahn. The president made those calls to McGahn after McGahn had specifically told the president that the White House counsel's office and McGahn himself could not be involved in pressing conflicts claims, and that the president should consult with his personal counsel if he wished to raise conflicts. Instead of relying on his personal counsel to submit the conflicts claims, the president sought to use his official powers to remove the special counsel. And after the media reported on the president's actions, he denied that he ever ordered McGahn to have the special counsel terminated and made repeated efforts to have McGahn deny the story, as discussed in Volume 2, Section 2.1, Infra. Those denials are contrary to the evidence and suggest the president's awareness that the direction to McGahn could be seen as improper.
F. The president's efforts to curtail the special counsel investigation. Overview. 2 days after the president directed McGahn to have the special counsel removed, the president made another attempt to affect the course of the Russia investigation. On June 19, 2017, the president met one-on-one with Corey Lewandowski in the Oval Office and dictated a message to be delivered to Attorney General Sessions that would have had the effect of limiting the Russia investigation to future election interference only. 1 month later, the president met again with Lewandowski and followed up on the request to have Sessions limit the scope of the Russia investigation. Lewandowski told the president the message would be delivered soon. Hours later, the president publicly criticized Sessions in an unplanned press interview, raising questions about Sessions' job security. 1. The president asks Corey Lewandowski to deliver a message to Sessions to curtail the special counsel investigation. On June 19, 2017, 2 days after the president directed McGahn to have the special counsel removed, the president met one-on-one in the Oval Office with his former campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski. Footnote 603. Senior White House advisors described Lewandowski as a devotee of the president and said the relationship between the president and Lewandowski was close. Footnote 604. During the June 19th meeting, Lewandowski recalled that, after some small talk, the president brought up Sessions and criticized his recusal from the Russia investigation. Footnote 605. The president told Lewandowski that Sessions was weak and that if the president had known about the likelihood of recusal in advance, he would not have appointed Sessions. Footnote 606. The president then asked Lewandowski to deliver a message to Sessions and said, "Write this down." Footnote 607. This was the first time the president had asked Lewandowski to take dictation, and Lewandowski wrote as fast as possible to make sure he captured the content correctly. Footnote 608. The president directed that Sessions should give a speech publicly announcing, "I know that I recused myself from certain things having to do with specific areas, but our POTUS is being treated very unfairly. He shouldn't have a special prosecutor counsel because he hasn't done anything wrong. I was on the campaign with him for 9 months. There were no Russians involved with him. I know it for a fact, because I was there. He didn't do anything wrong except he ran the greatest campaign in American history." Footnote 609. The dictated message went on to state that Sessions would meet with the special counsel to limit his jurisdiction to future election interference. "Now a group of people want to subvert the Constitution of the United States. I'm going to meet with the special prosecutor to explain this as very unfair and let the special prosecutor move forward with investigating election meddling for future elections so that nothing can happen in future elections. Footnote 610. The president said that if Sessions delivered that statement, he would be the most popular guy in the country. Footnote 611. Lewandowski told the president he understood what the president wanted Sessions to do. Footnote 612. Lewandowski wanted to pass the message to Sessions in person rather than over the phone. Footnote 613. He did not want to meet at the Department of Justice because he did not want a public log of his visit and did not want Sessions to have an advantage over him by meeting on what Lewandowski described as Sessions' turf. Footnote 614. Lewandowski called Sessions and arranged a meeting for the following evening at Lewandowski's office, but Sessions had to cancel due to a last-minute conflict. Footnote 615. Shortly thereafter, Lewandowski left Washington, D.C. without having had an opportunity to meet with Sessions to convey the president's message. Footnote 616. Lewandowski stored the notes in a safe at his home, which he stated was his standard procedure with sensitive items. Footnote 617. 2. The president follows up with Lewandowski. Following his June meeting with the president, Lewandowski contacted Rick Dearborn, then a senior White House official, and asked if Dearborn could pass a message to Sessions. Footnote 618. Dearborn agreed without knowing what the message was, and Lewandowski later confirmed that Dearborn would meet with Sessions for dinner in late July and could deliver the message then. Footnote 619. Lewandowski recalled thinking that the president had asked him to pass the message because the president knew Lewandowski could be trusted. But Lewandowski believed Dearborn would be a better messenger because he had a long-standing relationship with Sessions and because Dearborn was in the government while Lewandowski was not. Footnote 620. On July 19, 2017, the president again met with Lewandowski alone in the Oval Office. Footnote 621. In the preceding days, as described in Volume 2, Section 2G, Infra, emails and other information about the June 9, 2016 meeting between several Russians and Donald Trump Jr., Jared Kushner, and Paul Manafort had been publicly disclosed. In the July 19th meeting with Lewandowski, the president raised his previous request and asked if Lewandowski had talked to Sessions. Footnote 622. Lewandowski told the president that the message would be delivered soon. Footnote 623. Lewandowski recalled that the president told him that if Sessions did not meet with him, Lewandowski should tell Sessions he was fired. Footnote 624. Immediately following the meeting with the president, Lewandowski saw Dearborn in the anteroom outside the Oval Office and gave him a typewritten version of the message the president had dictated to be delivered to Sessions. Footnote 625. Lewandowski told Dearborn that the notes were the message they had discussed, but Dearborn did not recall whether Lewandowski said the message was from the president. Footnote 626. The message definitely raised an eyebrow for Dearborn, and he recalled not wanting to ask where it came from or think further about doing anything with it. Footnote 627. Dearborn also said that being asked to serve as a messenger to Sessions made him uncomfortable. Footnote 628. He recalled later telling Lewandowski that he had handled the situation, but he did not actually follow through with delivering the message to Sessions, and he did not keep a copy of the typewritten notes Lewandowski had given him. Footnote 629. 3. The president publicly criticizes Sessions in a New York Times interview. Within hours of the president's meeting with Lewandowski on July 19, 2017, the president gave an unplanned interview to the New York Times in which he criticized Sessions' decision to recuse from the Russia investigation. Footnote 630. The president said that Sessions should have never recused himself, and if he was going to recuse himself, he should have told me before he took the job and I would have picked somebody else. Footnote 631. Sessions' recusal, the president said, was very unfair to the president. How do you take a job and then recuse yourself? If he would have recused himself before the job, I would have said, "Thanks, Jeff, but I can't, you know. I'm not going to take you." It's extremely unfair, and that's a mild word to the president. Footnote 632. Hicks, who was present for the interview, recalled trying to throw herself between the reporters and the president to stop parts of the interview, but the president loved the interview. Footnote 633. Later that day, Lewandowski met with Hicks and they discussed the president's New York Times interview. Footnote 634. Lewandowski recalled telling Hicks about the president's request that he meet with Sessions and joking with her about the idea of firing Sessions as a private citizen if Sessions would not meet with him. Footnote 635. As Hicks remembered the conversation, Lewandowski told her the president had recently asked him to meet with Sessions and deliver a message that he needed to do the right thing and resign. Footnote 636. While Hicks and Lewandowski were together, the president called Hicks and told her he was happy with how coverage of his New York Times interview criticizing Sessions was playing out. Footnote 637. 4. The president orders Priebus to demand Sessions' resignation. 3 days later, on July 21, 2017, The Washington Post reported that U.S. intelligence intercepts showed that Sessions had discussed campaign-related matters with the Russian ambassador, contrary to what Sessions had said publicly. Footnote 638. That evening, Priebus called Hunt to talk about whether Sessions might be fired or might resign. Footnote 639. Priebus had previously talked to Hunt when the media had reported on tensions between Sessions and the president, and, after speaking to Sessions, Hunt had told Priebus that the president would have to fire Sessions if he wanted to remove Sessions because Sessions was not going to quit. Footnote 640. According to Hunt, who took contemporaneous notes of the July 21st call, Hunt told Priebus that, as they had previously discussed, Sessions had no intention of resigning. Footnote 641. Hunt asked Priebus what the president would accomplish by firing Sessions, pointing out there was an investigation before and there would be an investigation after. Footnote 642. Early the following morning, July 22, 2017, the president tweeted, "A new intelligence leak from the Amazon Washington Post, this time against AG Jeff Sessions. These illegal leaks, like Comey's, must stop." Footnote 643. Approximately 1 hour later, the president tweeted, "So many people are asking, why isn't the AG or special counsel looking at the many Hillary Clinton or Comey crimes? 33,000 emails deleted?" Footnote 644. Later that morning, while aboard Marine One on the way to Norfolk, Virginia, the president told Priebus that he had to get Sessions to resign immediately. Footnote 645. The president said that the country had lost confidence in Sessions and the negative publicity was not tolerable. Footnote 646. According to contemporaneous notes taken by Priebus, the president told Priebus to say that he needed a letter of resignation on his desk immediately and that Sessions had no choice but must immediately resign. Footnote 647. Priebus replied that if they fired Sessions, they would never get a new attorney general confirmed, and that the Department of Justice and Congress would turn their backs on the president. But the president suggested he could make a recess appointment to replace Sessions. Footnote 648. Priebus believed that the president's request was a problem, so he called McGahn and asked for advice, explaining that he did not want to pull the trigger on something that was all wrong. Footnote 649. Although the president tied his desire for Sessions to resign to Sessions' negative press and poor performance in congressional testimony, Priebus believed that the president's desire to replace Sessions was driven by the president's hatred of Sessions' recusal from the Russia investigation. Footnote 650. McGahn told Priebus not to follow the president's order and said they should consult their personal counsel, with whom they had attorney-client privilege. Footnote 651. McGahn and Priebus discussed the possibility that they would both have to resign rather than carry out the president's order to fire Sessions. Footnote 652. That afternoon, The president followed up with Priebus about demanding Sessions' resignation, using words to the effect of, "Did you get it? Are you working on it?" Footnote 653. Priebus said that he believed that his job depended on whether he followed the order to remove Sessions, although the president did not directly say so. Footnote 654. Even though Priebus did not intend to carry out the president's directive, he told the president he would get Sessions to resign. Footnote 655. Later in the day, Priebus called the president and explained that it would be a calamity if Sessions resigned because Priebus expected that Rosenstein and Associate Attorney General Rachel Brand would also resign and the president would be unable to get anyone else confirmed. Footnote 656. The president agreed to hold off on demanding Sessions' resignation until after the Sunday shows the next day to prevent the shows from focusing on the firing. Footnote 657. By the end of that weekend, Priebus recalled that the president relented and agreed not to ask Sessions to resign. Footnote 658. Over the next several days, the president tweeted about Sessions. On the morning of Monday, July 24, 2017, the president criticized Sessions for neglecting to investigate Clinton and called him beleaguered. Footnote 659. On July 25, the president tweeted, "Attorney General Jeff Sessions has taken a very weak position on Hillary Clinton crimes. Where are emails and DNC server and intel leakers?" Footnote 660. The following day, July 26, the president tweeted, "Why didn't AG Sessions replace acting FBI Director Andrew McCabe, a Comey friend who was in charge of Clinton investigation?" Footnote 661. According to Hunt, in light of the president's frequent public attacks, Sessions prepared another resignation letter and for the rest of the year carried it with him in his pocket every time he went to the White House. Footnote 662. Analysis. In analyzing the president's efforts to have Lewandowski deliver a message directing Sessions to publicly announce that the special counsel investigation would be confined to future election interference, the following evidence is relevant to the elements of obstruction of justice. A. Obstructive Act. The president's effort to send Sessions a message through Lewandowski would qualify as an obstructive act if it would naturally obstruct the investigation and any grand jury proceedings that might flow from the inquiry. The president sought to have Sessions announce that the president shouldn't have a special prosecutor counsel and that Sessions was going to meet with the special prosecutor to explain this is very unfair and let the special prosecutor move forward with investigating election meddling for future elections so that nothing can happen in future elections. The president wanted Sessions to disregard his recusal from the investigation, which had followed from a formal DOJ ethics review, and have Sessions declare that he knew, for a fact, that there were no Russians involved with the campaign because he was there. The president further directed that Sessions should explain that the president should not be subject to an investigation because he hasn't done anything wrong. Taken together, the president's directives indicate that Sessions was being instructed to tell the special counsel to end the existing investigation into the president and his campaign, with the special counsel being permitted to move forward with investigating election meddling for future elections. B. Nexus to an official proceeding. As described above, by the time of the president's initial one-on-one meeting with Lewandowski on June 19, 2017, the existence of a grand jury investigation supervised by the special counsel was public knowledge. By the time of the president's follow-up with Lewandowski, redaction, grand jury. See Volume 2, Section 2, G, Infra. To satisfy the nexus requirement, it would be necessary to show that limiting the special counsel's investigation would have the natural and probable effect of impeding that grand jury proceeding. C. Intent. Substantial evidence indicates that the president's effort to have Sessions limit the scope of the special counsel's investigation to future election interference was intended to prevent further investigative scrutiny of the president's and his campaign's conduct. As previously described, see Volume 2, Section 2B, Supra, the president knew that the Russia investigation was focused in part on his campaign, and he perceived allegations of Russian interference to cast doubt on the legitimacy of his election. The president further knew that the investigation had broadened to include his own conduct and whether he had obstructed justice. Those investigations would not proceed if the special counsel's jurisdiction were limited to future election interference only. The timing and circumstances of the president's actions support the conclusion that he sought that result. The president's initial direction that Sessions should limit the special counsel's investigation came just 2 days after the president had ordered McGahn to have the special counsel removed, which itself followed public reports that the president was personally under investigation for obstruction of justice. The sequence of those events raises an inference that after seeking to terminate the special counsel, the president sought to exclude his and his campaign's conduct from the investigation's scope. The president raised the matter with Lewandowski again on July 19, 2017, just days after emails and information about the June 9, 2016 meeting between Russians and senior campaign officials had been publicly disclosed, generating substantial media coverage and investigative interest. The manner in which the president acted provides additional evidence of his intent. Rather than rely on official channels, the president met with Lewandowski alone in the Oval Office. The president selected a loyal devotee outside the White House to deliver the message, supporting an inference that he was working outside White House channels, including McGahn, who had previously resisted contacting the Department of Justice about the special counsel. The president also did not contact the acting attorney general, who had just testified publicly that there was no cause to remove the special counsel. Instead, the president tried to use Sessions to restrict and redirect the special counsel's investigation when Sessions was recused and could not properly take any action on it. The July 19, 2017 events provide further evidence of the president's intent. The president followed up with Lewandowski in a separate one-on-one meeting 1 month after he first dictated the message for Sessions, demonstrating he still sought to pursue the request. And just hours after Lewandowski assured the president that the message would soon be delivered to Sessions, the president gave an unplanned interview to the New York Times in which he publicly attacked Sessions and raised questions about his job security. 4 days later, on July 22, 2017, the president directed Priebus to obtain Sessions' resignation. That evidence could raise an inference that the president wanted Sessions to realize that his job might be on the line as he evaluated whether to comply with the president's direction that Sessions publicly announced that, notwithstanding his recusal, he was going to confine the special counsel's investigation to future election interference. G. The president's efforts to prevent disclosure of emails about the June 9, 2016 meeting between Russians and senior campaign officials. Overview. By June 2017, the president became aware of emails setting up the June 9, 2016 meeting between senior campaign officials and Russians who offered derogatory information on Hillary Clinton as part of Russia and its government support for Mr. Trump. On multiple occasions, in late June and early July 2017, the president directed aides not to publicly disclose the emails, and he then dictated a statement about the meeting to be issued by Donald Trump Jr., describing the meeting as about adoption. Evidence. 1. The president learns about the existence of emails concerning the June 9, 2016 Trump Tower meeting. In mid-June 2017, the same week that the president first asked Lewandowski to pass a message to Sessions, senior administration officials became aware of emails exchanged during the campaign arranging a meeting between Donald Trump Jr., Paul Manafort, Jared Kushner, and a Russian attorney, footnote 663. As described in Volume 1, Section 4A5, Supra, the emails stated that the Crown, prosecutor of Russia, had offered to provide the Trump campaign with some official documents and information that would incriminate Hillary and her dealings with Russia as part of Russia and its government's support for Mr. Trump, footnote 664. Trump Jr. responded, "If it's what you say, I love it," footnote 665. And he, Kushner, and Manafort met with the Russian attorney and several other Russian individuals at Trump Tower on June 9, 2016, footnote 666. At the meeting, the Russian attorney claimed that funds derived from illegal activities in Russia were provided to Hillary Clinton and other Democrats, and the Russian attorney then spoke about the Magnitsky Act, a 2012 U.S. statute that imposed financial and travel sanctions on Russian officials and that had resulted in a retaliatory ban in Russia on U.S. adoptions of Russian children, footnote 667. According to written answers submitted by the president in response to questions from this office, the president had no recollection of learning of the meeting or the emails setting it up at the time the meeting occurred or at any other time before the election, footnote 668. The Trump campaign had previously received a document request from SSCI that called for the production of various information, including a list and a description of all meetings between any individual affiliated with the Trump campaign and any individual formally or informally affiliated with the Russian government or Russian business interests, which took place between June 16, 2015 and 12 p.m. on January 20, 2017, and associated records, footnote 669. Trump Organization attorneys became aware of the June 9th meeting no later than the first week of June 2017, when they began interviewing the meeting participants, and the Trump Organization attorneys provided the emails setting up the meeting to the president's personal counsel, footnote 670. Mark Corallo, who had been hired as a spokesman for the president's personal legal team, recalled that he learned about the June 9th meeting around June 21st or 22nd, 2017, footnote 671. Priebus recalled learning about the June 9th meeting from Fox News host Sean Hannity in late June 2017, footnote 672. Priebus notified one of the president's personal attorneys, who told Priebus he was already working on it, footnote 673. By late June, several advisors recalled receiving media inquiries that could relate to the June 9th meeting, footnote 674. 2. The president directs communication staff not to publicly disclose information about the June 9th meeting. Communications advisors Hope Hicks and Josh Raffel recalled discussing with Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump that the emails were damaging and would inevitably be leaked, footnote 675. Hicks and Raffel advised that the best strategy was to proactively release the emails to the press, footnote 676. On or about June 22, 2017, Hicks attended a meeting in the White House residence with the president, Kushner, and Ivanka Trump, footnote 677. According to Hicks, Kushner said that he wanted to fill the president in on something that had been discovered in the documents he was to provide to the congressional committees involving a meeting with him, Manafort, and Trump Jr., footnote 678. Kushner brought a folder of documents to the meeting and tried to show them to the president. But the president stopped Kushner and said he did not want to know about it, shutting the conversation down. Footnote 679. On June 28, 2017, Hicks viewed the emails at Kushner's attorney's office. Footnote 680. She recalled being shocked by the emails because they looked really bad. Footnote 681. The next day, Hicks spoke privately with the president to mention her concern about the emails, which she understood were soon going to be shared with Congress, footnote 682. The president seemed upset because too many people knew about the emails, and he told Hicks that just one lawyer should deal with the matter, footnote 683. The president indicated that he did not think the emails would leak, but said they would leak if everyone had access to them, footnote 684. Later that day, Hicks, Kushner, and Ivanka Trump went together to talk to the president, footnote 685. Hicks recalled that Kushner told the president the June 9th meeting was not a big deal and was about Russian adoption, but that emails existed setting up the meeting, footnote 686. Hicks said she wanted to get in front of the story and have Trump Jr. release the emails as part of an interview with Softball Questions, footnote 687. The president said he did not want to know about it, and they should not go to the press, footnote 688. Hicks warned the president that the emails were really bad and the story would be massive when it broke. But the president was insistent that he did not want to talk about it and said he did not want details, footnote 689. Hicks recalled that the president asked Kushner when his document production was due, footnote 690. Kushner responded that it would be a couple of weeks, and the president said, "Then leave it alone," footnote 691. Hicks also recalled that the president said Kushner's attorney should give the emails to whomever he needed to give them to, but the president did not think they would be leaked to the press, footnote 692. Raffel later heard from Hicks that the president had directed the group not to be proactive in disclosing the emails because the president believed they would not leak, footnote 693. 3. The president directs Trump Jr.'s response to press inquiries about the June 9th meeting. The following week, the president departed on an overseas trip for the G20 summit in Hamburg, Germany, accompanied by Hicks, Raffel, Kushner, and Ivanka Trump, among others, footnote 694. On July 7th, 2017, while the president was overseas, Hicks and Raffel learned that the New York Times was working on a story about the June 9th meeting, footnote 695. The next day, Hicks told the president about the story, and he directed her not to comment, footnote 696. Hicks thought the president's reaction was odd, because he usually considered not responding to the press to be the ultimate sin, footnote 697. Later that day, Hicks and the president again spoke about the story, footnote 698. Hicks recalled that the president asked her what the meeting had been about, and she said that she had been told the meeting was about Russian adoption, footnote 699. The president responded, "Then just say that," footnote 700. On the flight home from the G20 on July 8, 2017, Hicks obtained a draft statement about the meeting to be released by Trump Jr. and brought it to the president, footnote 701. The draft statement began with a reference to the information that was offered by the Russians in setting up the meeting. "I was asked to have a meeting by an acquaintance I knew from the 2013 Miss Universe pageant with an individual who I was told might have information helpful to the campaign," footnote 702. Hicks again wanted to disclose the entire story, but the president directed that the statement not be issued because it said too much, footnote 703. The president told Hicks to say only that Trump Jr. took a brief meeting and it was about Russian adoption, footnote 704. After speaking with the president, Hicks texted Trump Jr. a revised statement on the June 9th meeting that read, "It was a short meeting. I asked Jared and Paul to stop by. We discussed a program about the adoption of Russian children that was active and popular with American families years ago and was since ended by the Russian government. But it was not a campaign issue at that time, and there was no follow-up," footnote 705. Hicks's text concluded, "Are you okay with this? Attributed to you," footnote 706. Trump Jr. responded by text message that he wanted to add the word "primarily" before "discussed," so that the statement would read, "We primarily discussed a program about the adoption of Russian children," footnote 707. Trump Jr. texted that he wanted the change because "they started with some Hillary thing which was BS and some other nonsense which we shot down fast," footnote 708. Hicks texted back, "I think that's right too, but boss man worried it invites a lot of questions. Ultimately, defer to you and your attorney on that word because I know it's important and I think the mention of a campaign issue adds something to it in case we have to go further," footnote 709. Trump Jr. responded, "If I don't have it in there, it appears as though I'm lying later when they inevitably leak something," footnote 710. Trump Jr.'s statement, adding the word "primarily" and making other minor additions, was then provided to the New York Times, footnote 711. The full statement provided to the Times stated, "It was a short introductory meeting. I asked Jared and Paul to stop by. We primarily discussed a program about the adoption of Russian children that was active and popular with American families years ago and was since ended by the Russian government, but it was not a campaign issue at the time and there was no follow-up. I was asked to attend the meeting by an acquaintance, but was not told the name of the person I would be meeting with beforehand. Footnote 712. The statement did not mention the offer of derogatory information about Clinton or any discussion of the Magnitsky Act or U.S. sanctions, which were the principal subjects of the meeting, as described in Volume 1, Section 4A5, Supra. A short while later, while still on Air Force One, Hicks learned that Priebus knew about the emails, which further convinced her that additional information about the June 9th meeting would leak and the White House should be proactive and get in front of the story. Footnote 713. Hicks recalled again going to the president to urge him that they should be fully transparent about the June 9th meeting, but he again said no, telling Hicks, "You've given a statement, we're done." Footnote 714. Later on the flight home, Hicks went to the president's cabin, where the president was on the phone with one of his personal attorneys. Footnote 715. At one point, the president handed the phone to Hicks, and the attorney told Hicks that he had been working with Circa News on a separate story and that she should not talk to the New York Times. Footnote 716. 4. The media reports on the June 9, 2016 meeting. Before the president's flight home from the G20 landed, the New York Times published its story about the June 9, 2016 meeting. Footnote 717. In addition to the statement from Trump Jr., the Times story also quoted a statement from Corallo on behalf of the president's legal team suggesting that the meeting might have been a setup by individuals working with the firm that produced the Steele reporting. Footnote 718. Corallo also worked with Circa News on a story published an hour later that questioned whether Democratic operatives had arranged the June 9th meeting to create the appearance of improper connections between Russia and Trump family members. Footnote 719. Hicks was upset about Corallo's public statement and called him that evening to say the president had not approved the statement. Footnote 720. The next day, July 9, 2017, Hicks and the president called Corallo together and the president criticized Corallo for the statement he had released. Footnote 721. Corallo told the president the statement had been authorized and further observed that Trump Jr.'s statement was inaccurate and that a document existed that would contradict it. Footnote 722. Corallo said that he purposely used the term document to refer to the emails setting up the June 9th meeting because he did not know what the president knew about the emails. Footnote 723. Corallo recalled that when he referred to the document on the call with the president, Hicks responded that only a few people had access to it and said, "It will never get out." Footnote 724. Corallo took contemporaneous notes of the call that say, "Also mention existence of doc. Hope says, only a few people have it. It will never get out." Footnote 725. Hicks later told investigators that she had no memory of making that comment and had always believed the emails would eventually be leaked, but she might have been channeling the president on the phone call because it was clear to her throughout her conversations with the president that he did not think the emails would leak. Footnote 726. On July 11, 2017, Trump Jr. posted redacted images of the emails setting up the June 9th meeting on Twitter. The New York Times reported that he did so after being told that the Times was about to publish the content of the emails. Footnote 727. Later that day, the media reported that the president had been personally involved in preparing Trump Jr.'s initial statement to the New York Times that had claimed the meeting primarily concerned a program about the adoption of Russian children. Footnote 728. Over the next several days, the president's personal counsel repeatedly and inaccurately denied that the president played any role in drafting Trump Jr.'s statement. Footnote 729. After consulting with the president on the issue, White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders told the media that the president certainly didn't dictate the statement, but that he weighed in, offered suggestions like any father would do. Footnote 730. Several months later, the president's personal counsel stated in a private communication to the special counsel's office that the president dictated a short but accurate response to the New York Times article on behalf of his son, Donald Trump Jr., footnote 731. The president later told the press that it was irrelevant whether he dictated the statement and said, "It's a statement to the New York Times. That's not a statement to a high tribunal of judges." Footnote 732. On July 12, 2017, the special counsel's office, redaction, grand jury, Trump Jr., redaction, grand jury, related to the June 9th meeting and those who attended the June 9th meeting. Footnote 733. On July 19, 2017, the president had his follow-up meeting with Lewandowski and then met with reporters for the New York Times. In addition to criticizing Sessions in his Times interview, the president addressed the June 9, 2016 meeting and said he didn't know anything about the meeting at the time. Footnote 734. The president added, "As I've said, most other people, you know, when they call up and say, 'By the way, we have information on your opponent,' I think most politicians, I was just with a lot of people, they said, 'Who wouldn't have taken a meeting like that?'" Footnote 735. Analysis. In analyzing the president's actions regarding the disclosure of information about the June 9th meeting, the following evidence is relevant to the elements of obstruction of justice. A. Obstructive act. On at least three occasions between June 29, 2017 and July 9, 2017, the president directed Hicks and others not to publicly disclose information about the June 9, 2016 meeting between senior campaign officials and a Russian attorney. On June 29th, Hicks warned the president that the emails setting up the June 9th meeting were really bad and the story would be massive when it broke, but the president told her and Kushner to leave it alone. Early on July 8th, after Hicks told the president the New York Times was working on a story about the June 9th meeting, the president directed her not to comment, even though Hicks said that the president usually considered not responding to the press to be the ultimate sin. Later that day, the president rejected Trump Jr.'s draft statement that would have acknowledged that the meeting was with an individual who I was told might have information helpful to the campaign. The president then dictated a statement to Hicks that said the meeting was about Russian adoption, which the president had twice been told was discussed at the meeting. The statement dictated by the president did not mention the offer of derogatory information about Clinton. Each of these efforts by the president involved his communications team and was directed at the press. They would amount to obstructive acts only if the president, by taking these actions, sought to withhold information from or mislead congressional investigators or the special counsel. On May 17, 2017, the president's campaign received a document request from SSCI that clearly covered the June 9th meeting and underlying emails, and those documents also plainly would have been relevant to the special counsel's investigation. But the evidence does not establish that the president took steps to prevent the emails or other information about the June 9th meeting from being provided to Congress or the special counsel. The series of discussions, in which the president sought to limit access to the emails and prevent their public release, occurred in the context of developing a press strategy. The only evidence we have of the president discussing the production of documents to Congress or the special counsel is the conversation on June 29, 2017, when Hicks recalled the president acknowledging that Kushner's attorney should provide emails related to the June 9th meeting to whomever he needed to give them to. We do not have evidence of what the president discussed with his own lawyers at that time. B. Nexus to an official proceeding. As described above, by the time of the president's attempts to prevent the public release of the emails regarding the June 9th meeting, the existence of a grand jury investigation supervised by the special counsel was public knowledge, and the president had been told that the emails were responsive to congressional inquiries. To satisfy the nexus requirement, however, it would be necessary to show that preventing the release of the emails to the public would have the natural and probable effect of impeding the grand jury proceeding or congressional inquiries. As noted above, the evidence does not establish that the president sought to prevent disclosure of the emails in those official proceedings. C. Intent. The evidence establishes the president's substantial involvement in the communication strategy related to information about his campaign's connections to Russia and his desire to minimize public disclosures about those connections. The president became aware of the emails no later than June 29, 2017, when he discussed them with Hicks and Kushner, and he could have been aware of them as early as June 2, 2017, when lawyers for the Trump Organization began interviewing witnesses who participated in the June 9th meeting. The president, thereafter, repeatedly rejected the advice of Hicks and other staffers to publicly release information about the June 9th meeting. The president expressed concern that multiple people had access to the emails and instructed Hicks that only one lawyer should deal with the matter. And the president dictated a statement to be released by Trump Jr. in response to the first press accounts of the June 9th meeting that said the meeting was about adoption. But as described above, the evidence does not establish that the president intended to prevent the special counsel's office or Congress from obtaining the emails setting up the June 9th meeting or other information about that meeting. The statement recorded by Corallo, that the emails will never get out, can be explained as reflecting a belief that the emails would not be made public if the president's press strategy were followed, even if the emails were provided to Congress and the special counsel. H. The president's further efforts to have the attorney general take over the investigation. Overview. From summer 2017 through 2018, the president attempted to have Attorney General Sessions reverse his recusal, take control of the special counsel's investigation, and order an investigation of Hillary Clinton. Evidence. 1. The president again seeks to have Sessions reverse his recusal. After returning Sessions' resignation letter at the end of May 2017, but before the president's July 19, 2017 New York Times interview in which he publicly criticized Sessions for recusing from the Russia investigation, the president took additional steps to have Sessions reverse his recusal. In particular, at some point after the May 17, 2017 appointment of the special counsel, Sessions recalled, the president called him at home and asked if Sessions would unrecuse himself. Footnote 736. According to Sessions, the president asked him to reverse his recusal so that Sessions could direct the Department of Justice to investigate and prosecute Hillary Clinton, and the gist of the conversation was that the president wanted Sessions to unrecuse from all of it, including the special counsel's Russia investigation. Footnote 737. Sessions listened, but did not respond, and he did not reverse his recusal or order an investigation of Clinton. Footnote 738. In early 2017, the president asked Staff Secretary Rob Porter what he thought of Associate Attorney General Rachel Brand. Footnote 739. Porter recalled that the president asked him if Brand was good, tough, and on the team. Footnote 740. The president also asked if Porter thought Brand was interested in being responsible for the special counsel's investigation and whether she would want to be attorney general one day. Footnote 741. Because Porter knew Brand, the president asked him to sound her out about taking responsibility for the investigation and being attorney general. Footnote 742. Contemporaneous notes taken by Porter show that the president told Porter to keep in touch with your friend in reference to Brand. Footnote 743. Later, the president asked Porter a few times in passing whether he had spoken to Brand, but Porter did not reach out to her because he was uncomfortable with the task. Footnote 744. In asking him to reach out to Brand, Porter understood the president to want to find someone to end the Russia investigation or fire the special counsel, although the president never said so explicitly. Footnote 745. Porter did not contact Brand because he was sensitive to the implications of that action and did not want to be involved in a chain of events associated with an effort to end the investigation or fire the special counsel. Footnote 746. McGahn recalled that during the summer of 2017, he and the president discussed the fact that if Sessions were no longer in his position, the special counsel would report directly to a non-recused attorney general. Footnote 747. McGahn told the president that things might not change much under a new attorney general, footnote 748. McGahn also recalled that in or around July 2017, the president frequently brought up his displeasure with Sessions, footnote 749. Hicks recalled that the president viewed Sessions' recusal from the Russia investigation as an act of disloyalty, footnote 750. In addition to criticizing Sessions' recusal, the president raised other concerns about Sessions and his job performance with McGahn and Hicks, footnote 751. 2. Additional efforts to have Sessions unrecuse or direct investigations covered by his recusal. Later in 2017, the president continued to urge Sessions to reverse his recusal from campaign-related investigations and considered replacing Sessions with an attorney general who would not be recused. On October 16, 2017, the president met privately with Sessions and said that the Department of Justice was not investigating individuals and events that the president thought the department should be investigating, footnote 752. According to contemporaneous notes taken by Porter, who was at the meeting, the president mentioned Clinton's emails and said, "Don't have to tell us, just take a look," footnote 753. Sessions did not offer any assurances or promises to the president that the Department of Justice would comply with that request, footnote 754. 2 days later, on October 18, 2017, the president tweeted, "Wow, FBI confirms report that James Comey drafted letter exonerating crooked Hillary Clinton long before investigation was complete. Many people not interviewed, including Clinton herself. Comey stated under oath that he didn't do this. Obviously a fix. Where is Justice Department?" Footnote 755. On October 29, 2017, the president tweeted that there was anger and unity over a lack of investigation of Clinton and the Comey fix, and concluded, "Do something." Footnote 756. On December 6, 2017, 5 days after Flynn pleaded guilty to lying about his contacts with the Russian government, the president asked to speak with Sessions in the Oval Office at the end of a cabinet meeting. Footnote 757. During that Oval Office meeting, which Porter attended, the president again suggested that Sessions could unrecuse, which Porter linked to taking back supervision of the Russia investigation and directing an investigation of Hillary Clinton. Footnote 758. According to contemporaneous notes taken by Porter, the president said, "I don't know if you could unrecuse yourself. You'd be a hero. Not telling you to do anything." Dershowitz says POTUS can get involved, can order AG to investigate. "I don't want to get involved. I'm not going to get involved. I'm not going to do anything or direct you to do anything. I just want to be treated fairly." Footnote 759. According to Porter's notes, Sessions responded, "We are taking steps. Whole new leadership team. Professionals will operate according to the law." Footnote 760. Sessions also said, "I never saw anything that was improper," which Porter thought was noteworthy because it did not fit with the previous discussion about Clinton. Footnote 761. Porter understood Sessions to be reassuring the president that he was on the president's team. Footnote 762. At the end of December, the president told the New York Times it was too bad that Sessions had recused himself from the Russia investigation. Footnote 763. When asked whether Holder had been a more loyal attorney general to President Obama than Sessions was to him, the president said, "I don't want to get into loyalty, but I will tell you that, I will say this, Holder protected President Obama, totally protected him. When you look at the things that they did, and Holder protected the president. And I have great respect for that, I'll be honest." Footnote 764. Later in January, the president brought up the idea of replacing Sessions and told Porter that he wanted to clean house at the Department of Justice. Footnote 765. In a meeting in the White House residence that Porter attended on January 27, 2018, Porter recalled that the president talked about the great attorneys he had in the past with successful win records, such as Roy Cohn and Jay Goldberg, and said that one of his biggest failings as president was that he had not surrounded himself with good attorneys, citing Sessions as an example. Footnote 766. The president raised Sessions' recusal and brought up and criticized the special counsel's investigation. Footnote 767. Over the next several months, the president continued to criticize Sessions in tweets and media interviews, and on several occasions appeared to publicly encourage him to take action in the Russia investigation despite his recusal. Footnote 768. On June 5, 2018, for example, the president tweeted, "The Russian witch hunt hoax continues. All because Jeff Sessions didn't tell me he was going to recuse himself. I would have quickly picked someone else. So much time and money wasted, so many lives ruined. And Sessions knew better than most that there was no collusion." Footnote 769. On August 1, 2018, the president tweeted that Attorney General Jeff Sessions should stop this rigged witch hunt right now. Footnote 770. On August 23, 2018, the president publicly criticized Sessions in a press interview and suggested that prosecutions at the Department of Justice were politically motivated because Paul Manafort had been prosecuted, but Democrats had not. Footnote 771. The president said, "I put in an attorney general that never took control of the Justice Department, Jeff Sessions." Footnote 772. That day, Sessions issued a press statement that said, "I took control of the Department of Justice the day I was sworn in. While I am Attorney General, the actions of the Department of Justice will not be improperly influenced by political considerations." Footnote 773. The next day, the president tweeted a response. "Department of Justice will not be improperly influenced by political considerations. Jeff, this is great. What everyone wants. So look into all of the corruption on the other side, including deleted emails, Comey lies and leaks, Mueller conflicts, McCabe, Strzok, Page, Orr, FISA abuse, Christopher Steele and his phony and corrupt dossier, the Clinton Foundation, illegal surveillance of Trump campaign, Russian collusion by Dems, and so much more. Open up the papers and documents without redaction? Come on, Jeff. You can do it. The country is waiting." Footnote 774. On November 7, 2018, the day after the midterm elections, the president replaced Sessions with Sessions' chief of staff as acting attorney general. Footnote 775. Analysis. In analyzing the president's efforts to have Sessions unrecuse himself and regain control of the Russia investigation, the following considerations and evidence are relevant to the elements of obstruction of justice. A. Obstructive act. To determine if the president's efforts to have the attorney general unrecuse could qualify as an obstructive act, it would be necessary to assess evidence on whether those actions would naturally impede the Russia investigation. That inquiry would take into account the supervisory role that the attorney general, if unrecused, would play in the Russia investigation. It also would have to take into account that the attorney general's recusal covered other campaign-related matters. The inquiry would not turn on what Attorney General Sessions would actually do if unrecused, but on whether the efforts to reverse his recusal would naturally have had the effect of impeding the Russia investigation. On multiple occasions in 2017, the president spoke with Sessions about reversing his recusal so that he could take over the Russia investigation and begin an investigation and prosecution of Hillary Clinton. For example, in early summer 2017, Sessions recalled the president asking him to unrecuse, but Sessions did not take it as a directive. When the president raised the issue again in December 2017, the president said, as recorded by Porter, "Not telling you to do anything. I'm not going to get involved. I'm not going to do anything or direct you to do anything. I just want to be treated fairly." The duration of the president's efforts, which spanned from March 2017 to August 2018, and the fact that the president repeatedly criticized Sessions in public and in private for failing to tell the president that he would have to recuse is relevant to assessing whether the president's efforts to have Sessions unrecuse could qualify as obstructive acts. B. Nexus to an official proceeding. As described above, by mid-June 2017, the existence of a grand jury investigation supervised by the special counsel was public knowledge. In addition, in July 2017, a different grand jury supervised by the special counsel was empaneled in the District of Columbia, and the press reported on the existence of this grand jury in early August 2017. Footnote 776. Whether the conduct towards the Attorney General would have a foreseeable impact on those proceedings turns on much of the same evidence discussed above with respect to the obstructive act element. C. Intent. There is evidence that at least one purpose of the President's conduct towards Sessions was to have Sessions assume control over the Russia investigation and supervise it in a way that would restrict its scope. By the summer of 2017, the President was aware that the special counsel was investigating him personally for obstruction of justice. And in the wake of the disclosures of emails about the June 9th meeting between Russians and senior members of the campaign, see Volume 2, Section 2G, Supra, it was evident that the investigation into the campaign now included the President's son, son-in-law, and former campaign manager. The President had previously and unsuccessfully sought to have Sessions publicly announce that the special counsel investigation would be confined to future election interference. Yet Sessions remained recused. In December 2017, shortly after Flynn pleaded guilty, the President spoke to Sessions in the Oval Office with only Porter present and told Sessions that he would be a hero if he unrecused. Porter linked that request to the President's desire that Sessions take back supervision of the Russia investigation and direct an investigation of Hillary Clinton. The President said in that meeting that he just wanted to be treated fairly, which could reflect his perception that it was unfair that he was being investigated while Hillary Clinton was not. But a principal effect of that act would be to restore supervision of the Russia investigation to the Attorney General, a position that the President frequently suggested should be occupied by someone like Eric Holder and Bobby Kennedy, who the President described as protecting their presidents. A reasonable inference from those statements and the President's actions is that the President believed that an unrecused Attorney General would play a protective role